This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency with information for business and IT professionals. To support this podcast, visit donation.ciaops.com. This is episode 50 with Susan Bradley.
Welcome along to a special Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. My name is Robert Crane, and I'm glad that everybody's joined us for this episode. I'm proud to announce that this podcast is now at its 50th episode. And for this episode, I've asked our original podcast invitee to come back. Welcome, Susan Bradley.
And I'm honored to be here on your 50th show. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yes, I started all the way back on August the 25th, 2010. So it's taken a long while to get to 50, but I think we've progressed a long way since the first one when it was all done. I think we did it over a live meeting, and it was,
right.
I think the audio quality was a bit poorer, but we've managed to improve all of that technology and push it out so it comes out through iTunes. So it's amazing what happens in a short, almost 3 years time. So
sure.
What I'll do is I'll let Susan introduce herself and let everybody know who you are and what you're doing.
As was said earlier, I'm Susan Bradley. My background is I'm a bean counter by trade, a CPA, but even that position is like changing in this day and age. Many, many years ago when I first started out in accounting work, we used to do old-fashioned bookkeeping. And we do not do old-fashioned bookkeeping anymore. Pretty much all of our clients do the bookkeeping. And we're in this, I would call, awkward growing stage transition-wise right now, where some people are in it, just like everyone else and everything else. Some people are very, very happy with on-premise accounting systems. They don't want it to go anywhere near the cloud. And then we've got the youngsters in our firm that are much, much more willing to have it on a hosted platform. And they're now QuickBooks Online, which is the primary accounting package, has a hosted online version. And it even hooks into your iPhone and your iPad. So these days, if you're on the go and you want to do an invoice out in the field, you can sign up for online QuickBooks and go to your iPad and put in your username and a password and get onto your accounting data and actually invoice from there and actually look at, you know, customer information. So what used to be pretty much the old-fashioned ledger, pencil, paper is now where it's in the palm of our hands, in our back pockets, and in our phones, and you name it these days. So our industry is changing too.
And I think, you know, part of it, the reason that I've asked Susan to come on and share her experience is the first thing is that she obviously is a certified practicing accountant in the US mainly. She does a lot of work else in the technology and is well known in the small business server and the technology field, the SMB space. But again, your primary, day-to-day job is around the accounting and the compliance. So one of the things I thought that would be interesting to get Susan's perspective on is as we are moving to the cloud and more information is moving that way, there have been some interesting questions and interesting conversations being raised about compliance. What happens when your data is stored in a hosted environment? How do you know that it's secure? I mean, obviously we know that the security is the main thing, but, you know, the auditing, the tracking, what actually needs to be done to make sure that we comply. So, I mean, where's that going, do you think?
And a lot of it is, you know, it gets back to the old-fashioned, you can outsource a lot of things, you can't outsource your accountability. Just today, a client sent me, they have a credit card. They are literally a bunch of nuns, Catholic nuns. They sell the liturgical, I'm going to massacre the name, liturgical vestments. It's all of the shawls and the robes and things, and they make them by hand. They don't use any, you know, sewing machines or anything like that. They make them by hand, and they have a gift shop, and they sell, and obviously in this day and age, they sell with credit cards. So here's a very old-fashioned industry. How many thousands of years old is the Catholic Church? And they sell things that use credit cards and have, what else, PCI compliance. So they reached out to me going, you know, what do we do with this? You know, we didn't put this credit card machine in. How do we comply with this? And it's a matter of, you know, I have to look at the statement that the merchant needs. It's a self-assessed questionnaire that you fill out. And you basically, you they are then outsourcing to me to then be the one to look through this and see if they comply with their PCI requirements. Out in the small business world, show me a small business server that runs credit cards through there, and I'll show you somebody who says, gee, I can't get it to pass a PCI test. So the industry, the main industry right now that has a lot of compliance, where you see it most, and especially it really, really hits the small business, is the credit card industry. I'm sure everyone has heard about Heartland Payment Group, where they've had data breaches. And in the credit card industry, they're wanting to make sure that you have some basic security requirements in play. And it's actually, when you read the self assessment checklist, it's actually a very good thing. Some of the things we should be doing and we don't do. It is my very opinionated opinion that if you accept credit cards and you store them inside a computer device that's inside of a network, I honestly do not believe a small business server environment can be secure and pass a PCI test. What I mean by that is, if you go look at the PCI checklist, there's quite a few, you know, you need to separate this network from that network. You need to separate this role from that role. You need to not be logging into an internet-facing device when you have credit card information. And guess what we have? That small business server is an internet-facing device. So one of the things we need to do as people looking at compliance is say, okay, number one, identify who you have to be compliant to. Sometimes that's a little tricky. Credit cards are the easiest. You go to the PCI compliance. I'm sure you have equivalency in Australia. Mm-hmm. It's also hard from the standpoint if you are working with a firm that has multiple locations. I'm sure in Australia you have firms that go worldwide. So you don't only have to worry about Australian laws. You have to worry about, I'm sure, Chinese laws, Hong Kong laws, and that's hard to do. So the best thing I'd recommend in that case is to reach out to another IT pro in that other area, or reach out to the client themselves, because they usually have an industry association that provides them with a lot of information about compliance. So step number one is find out who you need to be compliant with. That's step number one. Step number two is look at what kind of environment you have and see if you're, you know, how much work do you need to do in order to be compliant with that checklist or that industry or whatever. And especially right now when we're kind of reevaluating our networks and kind of rejiggering where we're putting things, it's a good time to step back and say, okay, is it really good that credit card information goes there? Maybe there's a better way to do it. Or is it good that email that contains personal identification information goes here and is not encrypted? Maybe there's a better way to do that. So again, step back and go, you know, where is this data going? Identify the critical data, and then where should it be going in a better way?
So, I mean, obviously what's happening is as our space is changing and our clients are driving, trying to drive the cost down, they're wanting to move their data and their information to the cloud for convenience, and a lot of the big vendors are pushing this. But it does raise some unique issues, some unique examples. So one of the examples that was brought to my attention recently was an organization that I know that basically goes in and does receiverships of business. They were called in to, do the receivership on a business, and the business hadn't been paying their hosting bills for 3 months. So when the receiver came in and said, well, we need to access all your emails and we need to follow the trail, the hostess said, well, we're not going to release any information or unlock those accounts until you pay us the outstanding money. And that was that's a very interesting, first time I'd heard of that. So again, this is one of these sort of situations that makes you step back and think, that we're going to see a lot more of that. I mean, what's your sort of reaction in general to the move to the cloud? I mean, is compliance going to be more challenging?
It depends. Don't you love that phrase? It depends. I'll tell you where it's going to be challenging. And it's one thing that the industry is, I don't think keeping up with it right now is, we specialize in litigation consulting. And so one of the things I help out with is forensic computing. I wouldn't say I'm as good as the big guys, that go out there and, I'm certainly not in the FBI range, and I'm certainly not, you know, where I take down an entire botnet or something like that. But certainly I go in, and if somebody says, you know, we need to find a certain email, we do a review and a forensic review of a computer system. Okay, it's easy, relatively easy for me to do that on a computer these days. I bring the hard drive in, I do an extraction of the data on the hard drive, I then run it through a tool that allows me to search for things. My job is done. Now, let's go and say, let's put all that email in the cloud. I then, you know, I now have to get either a authorization from the client. If it's a situation where we're on the other side, I may have to get some kind of legal authorization. I may have to get additional tools, because if it's in a tenant environment where I'm not allowed to see anything else but that client, I have to make sure I only extract data from the client. Like you said, what if they haven't been paying their bills? There's certainly information somewhere. At this point in time, we don't know if the hoster has deleted that information. Some hosters do keep it up there for a bit. Others turn it over so fast that that data is gone. As far as logging information is concerned, again, you know, how long do they keep their logs? We just had a KB article come out in regards to Office 365. And let's see if I remember the data points. It was, if you do a hard delete, that we're used to in the small business world, about a 30-day retention on emails. And when I say 30-day retention, that's assuming that you really, really do delete it, and not do like a lot of people do, where they delete it and it's in the deleted bin and it doesn't really get deleted, so it's still there. If you do a hard delete of the email and it is out of the Outlook client and it's sitting in Exchange server and it's got a 30-day time where it sits there before it deletes, Office 365 is only 14 days unless you change it. So knowing how much of a window you have to get things back. And that's a big change of, you know, we're kind of used to, oh yeah, fire up the server, go in, you know, get the Exchange database files, and it's not that way anymore. The other big change is, again, on-premise machine, I would look at the Internet Explorer history files. I would get DAT files off of there, see what they were, see what files they were accessing. If you have a Chrome machine, where's your log files? It's up in the Chrome browser. It's up on, you know, Google servers. So it's a big difference in how you can prove some of these things in the audit trail.
And another good example that I came across is, you know, a reseller came to me, same sort of, again, you know, company was put into receivership. You know, the auditors came in to check the business, and they'd been running on, you know, a cloud-based solution that they're running actually on Google. And before the receivers had taken, you know, possession or taken control, all the staff, including the managing director, had gone through and basically, you know, hard deleted all their emails. And the plan that they were on with Google, there was no recovery option. They'd been doing everything through a browser. When they did a hard, you know, a shift delete of everything, it was gone for good. There was no way at all it could be recovered. And there was, you know, something like $5 or $6 million worth of, you know, being owed to the creditors. I mean, that's a, you know, that's a very serious situation. You know, and again, it may be rare in this case, but as more and more information moves into that sort of space, we, you know, it's obviously not fair to the people that are out that amount of money being owed to them.
Right. And some of this is because it is a bit new. Some of the laws and regulations haven't shifted to take that into effect. When you do go onto cloud, one of the first things you need to ask yourself and ask, you know, as the business owner, as the IT decision maker, what is the retention period? How can I get my data back? When there is a, you know, can I move it to another location? Can I move it off? Can I, you know, somehow retain it? Even if it's in a different format, can I get that information off? Cloud, when you choose a cloud vendor, make sure it's a portable data. You can encrypt it, you can do whatever you want with it, but make sure that you can move it from, you know, wherever it's at to another location.
And I think part of that too is you know, again, the thing that I always recommend, especially in the Office 365 environment, and you know, I believe Google has the same sort of option. If you look at it, is the legal hold option. So again, you know, the small business plans, the cheaper plans, they're cheap for a reason. You know, they're basic emails, but you really got to look at it and say, as a professional, and you know, I want to make sure you as a customer are compliant. You know what? Paying that extra money for a mailbox that includes litigation hold, the ability basically to retain all changes and do discovery and retain information for whatever period of time, you know, it's going to pay for itself at some point down the track. So again, this is part of the thing that I try and inform retailers about. You see, you know, you really need to go to your customers and say, look, this is our recommendation because it gives you all of this, and sure, it's an additional cost. If they sign off and say, look, we don't necessarily want that, okay, they've made the decision. But I think you need to be, as Susan says, an informed reseller and go to them and say, you know what, this is a really good thing.
And certainly, and I'm sure Australia has similar laws, there's certain industries that if you do not follow the rules of retention of information, there's serious penalties involved.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the classic one for us is our tax department, our equivalent of the IRS, is that records need to be maintained, I believe, for 7 years. So again, if
ours are 7 as well.
Yeah, if they come to you and say, look, oh, we need to see the proof of this email, this receipt. Have you got it? So, oh, no. So it was deleted after 14 days. Sorry. Well, that's just not going to wash for them. The business is going to cop a fine because, again, part of the compliance that you operate under is having that information for a period of 7 years. So, again, I think, again, it's something that a lot of customers especially and maybe some resellers need to look at in this new transition to the cloud is to say, you know what, you know, we were comfortable with these tools and this ability in a on-premise small business service solution. And if the client does want to go to the cloud, well, what are our options to make sure they still do comply with that?
And Office 365 in that respect is the poster child of if you need to tell someone or you know, give to authority saying, you know, yes, it's certified in XYZ, it has about the most alphabet soup certifications that I've seen out there of the different, you know, because obviously they are worldwide and have to comply with quite a few things. I will say there's certain things about Office 365 that do annoy me as a control freak that I am. Because they cannot disclose everything, there are certain things that they keep close to the vest because it would be a risk and a security risk if they would be 100% open. And what I mean by that, if you ever go out and if you want to know the physical address of the data center that is running your mailbox, you will not find it. It's kind of like the Internal Revenue Service where you cannot find the actual street address of the building because it's a risk to the people working there to publish it. So they'll give you like a PO box or they'll give you some kind of, you know, alias to send information to. Same way with data centers. They do not publish the actual physical street address. Probably people in that area know where it's at, but they don't physically, you know, you can't go and knock on the door and say, I want to see my server that has my data on it. That's not going to happen.
Go on.
I was going to say, the other thing that does not happen is if, you know, I'm the control freak, I'm the patchaholic. People know me from years of you know, giving information about patching on the patchmanagement.org listserv as well as on Windows Secrets. And so, you know, I always say, you know, don't do this patch, don't do that patch. If you wanted to know exactly when XYZ patch was installed on a server, they don't do that as well. Again, that's another one of those. They don't tell you on Tuesday at 10:45 a.m. is when they bounce the servers because it would be a risk to the system to say, you know, when the patches were on. In addition, this is one of those things where I've heard enough rumors. I don't know for certain. Microsoft is one of those things where they let all customers be secure at the same time. But at the same time, Office 365 being a little bit more target on the front side, they take measures on Office 365 that they wouldn't normally take on the normal on-premise machine. And what I mean, and don't when people say, well, what do you mean you're not getting the same premise? It's just a matter of where you're putting the server and what things you would do to protect it. If you yourself was building cloud services, you would put things in front and you would take and do alternate things to give yourself time to deal with security issues. So I'm sure you're the same way, where you've heard hints and things that they do mitigation things that you wouldn't normally do for an on-premise server, just because they're where they are and who they are and what they do.
I think also too, the interesting thing was, and again, it was the point you raised there about the, you know, exact patch version and what levels this. And when I, you know, again, I think coming from a small business, you know, a small business server style environment, yeah, you know, you want KB article 946728 installed. Yes, it's installed. I can see it. I've actually installed it. I'm comfortable that it's there. You know, and wanting to see that on the data center. So when you take that back to the people who operate this, again, it's a completely different world once you start delving into it, because A, you've got, like you said, you know, the ability, the thing that people don't necessarily want to let you know the exact time they patch and when they reboot and their schedule, and it, you know, it's all being done. And the other side of the coin is now we're talking about, you know, massive scales of computers. There's not just one Exchange server running everybody's mailbox. There's, you know, in different data centers,
right,
and you know, front end servers, and so suddenly it becomes, you know, like I said, you could go to a walk into a premise and say, right, where's your, you know, server box? There it is, right, you know, run Windows update, right, reboot, patches are on, I know that, you know, I have full control of it. Now the game's very, very different, because again, you know, there it's just the scale of it, and trying to achieve that compliance is huge.
And this is where then you have to, you kind of have to, there's another level of compliance that now kicks in. So there's the level of certifications that the vendor has. And as I said many a time, in cloud computing, it is in their best interest to make sure they get it right. So first off, they have a business interest to make sure they're compliant and make sure that they produce a secure product. The next thing they do, there's several industries, the CPA world is one, that has certain certifications and auditing reports that are done for data centers and for outsourced services. And the one in particular from the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants is, it used to be called the SAS 70. If you see it on some of the pages as you enter into cloud services, you may see the old name was SAS 70, and you still may see that around a little bit. The new name is SSA 16. And it's basically a, where auditors go in and say, okay, you say you're doing X, I need to make sure that you're doing X, and I will certify then that you are doing the processes you're saying. There's also, there's other vendors and there's other organizations as well. The ISO, and I can't rattle off all the, I'm trying to remember the initials. If you go out to the Office 365 white paper, we'll put it in the show notes. There's an Office 365 white paper on security and compliance, and they list all of the vendors that they have to comply with. And it's all of the alphabet soup vendors that they have to have auditors come in and make sure that they're doing what they say they're doing. So basically, there's a layer of people out there that are now tasked with ensuring that what the vendor says they're doing with your data is what they're doing with your data.
So I think that, I mean, that's an interesting question, because again, you know, again, it's this scale of things. So we've got, you know, like you said, you know, you've got all these, you know, all these great certificates and ISO standards and you know, data safe harbor and all this sort of stuff. And that's great, you know, looks great. But again, if someone comes into your business when you've got an on-premise solution and says, right, you know, has your server got passwords longer than 16 characters or whatever? Yes, I can show you that. In the cloud, that's going to be tougher, because again, you when I sort of asked specific questions, it comes back to, oh yeah, well go and look at this, you know, look at the website, or we do this ISO standard. You'd have to drill into the ISO standard. We do conform to that. Again, it's this scale thing. You're used to a very small touch. You know, I can actually go and look at the DLL version myself. But now in the cloud, I've really got to up my trust level to sort of say, well, I can't really do much more, can I?
And this is that trust thing that you do have to step back a bit and say, you know, there are organizations, there's processes, No, I can't touch every single DLL on that cloud, but they're not going to be in business very long if they're not doing the right thing.
And I think that, and again, here's an interesting, again, another interesting, conversation. I think that you've got to look at, there are a lot of top line providers. So you've got, Office 365 through Microsoft, Google, Amazon. But then what about the compliance of maybe the lower tier players? You've got Rackspace, you've got, right down to a local provider who only services, one unique area. I mean, the big guys obviously are doing the compliance because they have to, they get lots of customers. But, I see a lot of resellers also going to smaller providers. I mean, there's a risk there, surely, isn't there, around compliance for them as well?
Yes, but at the same time, keep in mind that they won't be in business long if they aren't compliant and if they aren't doing a good job. I mean, it's to me, it's no different than the big guys or the little guys. The little guys, from the standpoint of they may not have all of the initials behind, but at the same time, they won't be in business long if they don't take it seriously as well.
So, but again, part of that is that as a, if you're a reseller, you're really going to have to know this or be comfortable with the business, the provider, the hosting company you use, are doing that compliance. They're up to scratch. They're going to survive, as you say.
And some of that is, I'd argue that you shouldn't be selling anything that you wouldn't be comfortable using yourself, or that you don't have some kind of services with them so that you know exactly what they're up to. If there's something that you kind of use that the bean counter, can they eat, is a phrase that my father is a retired Internal Revenue Service. And when he was auditing people and what they were reporting was not jiving with what he saw them doing, he'd always have this phrase, is like, how can they eat? If their income was this, and you're like, wait, they're not, something's not right here. The same thing when you're picking vendors and even the smaller vendors. If it doesn't feel right to you, if some of the answers they give you when you do start pushing them for answers, if they don't give you what you are comfortable with, then it's not somebody you want to do business with.
And I think that would it be also fair to say that coming from the the small business crowd or whatever, that it took a while for that community or the community to get security. I mean, basically they were just putting the boxes in, covering it all up. It would you say only it's only been of the last thing as they become more professional, they've worried about security, that they're going into that depth. So is that a fair comment?
I think we still have a ways to go, especially when it comes to small businesses and even larger businesses and the use of passwords and online these days. I mean, there's still so many times I see people reusing the same passwords and having really bad password practices. And right now, that's so front and center when it comes to cloud computing that a password is basically between you and that service. We don't do it well in on-premise, and I'd say we don't do it well in cloud and hosted yet.
And I think, and is it a fair comment? And this is something we chatted about just before we started. Is it going to get to a point where the people, the millennials, the people born after the year 2000, just don't care? I mean, they're doing everything in public
Yes.
anyway. I mean, so what? A password's a pain in the neck. I don't care. I mean, is it going to get to that stage?
I think so. I th as the Facebook generation grows up and us fuddy-duddies die off, I think it will get to that point where I think it's always going to be a balance between the end user and the accessibility and the bother of the security. There's always going to be a struggle. I don't think we're ever going to solve that. I mean, look at the infamous Star Wars, Star Trek. I mean, did they solve it? I don't think they solved it either.
Well, I think again, it's one of those, key things. And why do I need a complex password? And to an extent, the cloud, Office 365, for example, is enforcing that you do have a complex password. But again, then you get into these, and it's doing the inverted commas, the right things, and making you reset your password. But again, it's not something that the end users are comfortable with, or that they can manage, or they can handle. And this has always been the fallout, the fall down of any information service, whether it's on-prem or in the cloud.
you can see that already the number of services out there and the number of companies that are putting two factors, and they're trying to make two factor easy. So it's something that you don't, it's not going to be another password. It's going to be some other device or in the case of like, even in my office where we use AuthAnvil, it's on the phone. So it's not a bother. It's something we have with us at all times. And that's the key to making these kind of processes easy. I mean, if you think about Star Wars and Star Trek, I mean, they had, you know, it was their voice, wasn't it, that authenticated many things. So, I mean, they're going to make, we're going to have to evolve into having some kind of authentication devices that are easier to do and not, and, you know, less easy to spoof and things like that.
So, I mean, looking at the opportunity, obviously trying to get resellers into a position where they can make money out of, you know, the cloud services or make money on whatever IT is going forward. Would you say that there is an opportunity to for people who are looking to make more revenue, more opportunity to do a deep dive into the compliance, you know, push themselves as, you know, we've done the research and this is the compliance. Is there an opportunity to present that to customers? Is that something that would resonate with customers, do you think?
It is. I will warn you that it's not easy because you do usually have to have some kind of initials on the backside. It's an expensive profession, so it's one of those that, you know, go into it with your eyes wide open and realize that while it has a future, it's something that you have to do an investment in. These days, especially with so many different cloud services and offerings, it's, as a small business owner myself, you want to make sure you pick something that works. And being that kind of decision maker person that filters out all of the different products and all of the different offerings, even not getting into the compliance side, I see a need for some kind of trusted advisor, trusted person that says, no, that one doesn't work. We've used this in this kind of industry and it doesn't work over here. And, you know, we really recommend this. And because you really, you know, as a small business, you don't want to try something and go, oh, that didn't work. And let's pull out all of our data and now go try the next thing down the street. You want to pick something that will work for you.
And I think, again, part of it is you do need to look at the compliance side. I mean, obviously, when customers choose a cloud-based product, they look at a page and they normally pick the cheapest product because they're focused on price. But this is where the trusted advisor or the reseller can step in and say, well, okay, yes, we see that, but it doesn't include litigation hold. It doesn't include all these additional options that you've got. And again, that's where they can sell their services, their experience as a professional to the clients.
Right. Exactly.
And I think, again, that sort of echoes back to the, you know, the small business sort of field. You know, you would go into a business and say, well, you know what, we could put in all workstations, run a work group. But if you put a server in and spend a bit more money, you're going to get, you know, AD, you're going to get, you know, forcing secure passwords, group policy. So, again, it probably is something very similar.
And you know, it's always interesting too when people say, you know, oh, my small firms, they don't want the cloud. It's how you bring the cloud into the conversation. In my own firm, when I go to the partners and I say, you know, do you want us to move all the data and move all the email and move everything to the cloud and have it, you know, on a server? It'll be in a data center. It'll be, you know, secure and all this kind of stuff. They say flat out no. They want to make sure that they have access to where the data is, that they can, if someone comes in and says, where is my data, they can point to the box in the corner and say, it's there, regardless of the fact that there's, you know, backups, regardless of the fact that email goes through the cloud, regardless of anything else, they still are of the mindset that they want to point to the location. When I then change the phrase a little bit, if I change the question and I say, would you want a copy of the data in a cloud or a synchronized copy or something where, you know, fall over, that they're comfortable with and that they say, you know, they would be interested in something like that. So if your client isn't interested in everything in the cloud, you know, so many people these days are interested in a copy on the cloud or synchronization of the data on a cloud. And that's the kind of things you can look at as well.
And I think too, and a part of our earlier conversation is as those managers, those who have been in the game for a long time, move out of those roles. When you get people who are, who have had technology ubiquitous throughout their lives, they're probably not going to worry about it because they see the convenience. They're comfortable with the, the data living somewhere else. And that's definitely the trend. But you're right. I mean, it's a matter of going to the customer and explaining to it. But I think. Part of it is to present a balanced argument, to be informed in the choices and in the options that you're presenting. It's okay, well, if you do it this way, these are the advantages. If you do it that way, and again, I see that no different as stuff that any traditional reseller has done for clients. It's just a matter of, importantly, you need to be informed and, again, look into the products rather than looking simply at price.
True.
So I think, I would suggest that, part of it is that with so many offerings too, with the cloud, that's where you get the complication. I mean, everybody in the community is normally centered around, the Microsoft product and the SBS and all, and there really wasn't another player in the market. But the difference now is potentially you've got more than just, a single supplier. I mean, in your estimation or your experience, do you think that will continue, or do you think we will see a consolidation perhaps into, the one or the two big players?
I think it's going to continue, and the reason why I say that is because as my vendors move to a cloud, right now the bulk of my vendors still code for the traditional server in the corner of the room, desktops connected. As they go online and as they go hosted, they don't necessarily pick the Microsoft stack. They're not necessarily on Azure and things like that. They're on, like Lacerte is putting things on Amazon Web Services. So as they move to a cloud, it'll be interesting to see what will happen, because as my requirements for having a server in the corner change to where I just need a browser to get to a thing, I don't think it's going to be, I will just need a device. I mean, it's one of the big headlines these days is, is Microsoft becoming irrelevant? It'll be interesting to see what happens. I think they're still going to be relevant, just not as relevant as they used to be. It won't be quite as need to all pick this platform because we won't know what the platform is. Our vendor will pick whatever platform that they code and put the hosted service on. We will just need some kind of browser to get us there.
So I think, again, a lot of this is, we're changing, the major change in technology and the bandwidth is still a limitation for many businesses and, the way is generally, the move to the cloud as people, become more comfortable with it, move into senior positions. It's something that we would all suggest probably can't be ignored. And again, it's a matter of being well informed, especially around the compliance and the security and all that sort of stuff. I mean, what's your recommendation? What's the best place to start looking for that sort of information? Is that, we go trolling through websites, or do you tap somebody perhaps in the community, or, is it that easy or that difficult to find?
Start out with, there's a really good place called Cloud Security Alliance, and I'll give some of these links in your show notes. There's a notorious nine computing threats. If you want to get more interested in compliance, I would probably start out with some of the more IT related compliance ones, like looking in the A++. You can also look at the CISSP. There's a couple of people out on the SMB managed services list that are very helpful in kind of, if you reach out to them and kind of, throw some threads out there and say, hey, I'm kind of interested in some compliance, they will warn you it is not easy. They will warn you that it's an investment. It's not going to be one of these, kind of, any kind of compliance usually is not kind of some kind of paper mill Microsoft certification. It's not something where you get it and then you put the letters behind your name and you never really worry about it after that. Usually compliance certifications need annual recertification. They'll need annual education. So it is, like I said, it is an investment. But certainly reach out to the guys on the SMB managed services list and just say, hey, I'm kind of, you know, interested in that. I'm toying into that. What are you seeing? And there's a couple of gentlemen out there in particular that are very helpful in sharing.
So in general, I mean, we're just talking for the, you know, the average reseller. I mean, is compliance something they need to pay attention to? Obviously, I would say it certainly sounds as though you would, even on-prem or even in the cloud, it is a very important part of businesses going forward.
Let's not even put cloud on the table. Let's get into lowest common denominator, what I would consider the lowest amount of technology. Any kind of credit card scanning device, even if it's the plain old telephone device, requires a piece of paper and a checklist, and you have to call up the merchant vendor and say, yes, I'm compliant. Yes, I take care of the credit card information. No, I don't save it. I shred it or destroy it or whatever. There's compliance even in as little technology as a little tiny telephone-based scanning device. You have to say that you're compliant. And, you know, here's a situation where I've got customers that go, gee, the bank just put this in. I have no idea. What are these questions? Can you fill this out for me? And I say, sure, just, you know, fax it over. I'll take care of it. So even as low end of technology as that is a compliance project.
And would it be fair to say also in your experience, are you seeing more, you know, discovery requests, e-discovery requests, you know, those sort of things being made out there?
Certainly in our litigation environment, when we many, many years ago, we used to say, you know, we want to see the paper ledgers. We like to see copies of the ledgers. Now we don't even say copies of the paper ledgers. We literally write down there, we want to see electronic, the backups. We want to see this information. You know, we will specify if the job requires looking at emails and communication, we will specify that. The entire e-discovery. And if you're interested, let's now go to where you're not looking at the compliance of technology, but you're looking at investigating in the forensics. There's a firm down in California, Pasadena, Guidance Software down in Pasadena. They have a certification process as well for their technology, and it's a forensic tools that goes through and will gather information, look at data. It's basically an overgrown search tool, if you will, where you extract the data from the hard drive, you put in you put in your search queries, and then you get the information out from the data. As they go more cloud-based, that industry is changing as well. So they're starting to get more tools that look into browser-based artifacts, as it's called. So there's that whole, that's another kind of compliance and investigation industry that people may want to look into, because that's also getting bigger and bigger and more complicated and changing all the time.
So it would be fair to say, I think, based on our conversation, as we look towards, you know, wrapping this up, you would say that no matter what the technology, you know, security is still going to be important, compliance is still going to be important, and if anything, you know, discovery and e-discovery is something that will become more and more important based on the fact that our communications are basically all digital now.
Right.
So I think that, you know, in summary, what we could probably take away is that, you know, if these things are important or growing in importance, and like them or not, there is something that all businesses need to be aware of and may need to conform to. There's an opportunity for, you know, people to become firstly more involved or specialize in that stack or included in what they're offering. You know, so that they can generate revenue. But on the other side, if they're not interested in that, it doesn't mean that you should shy away from it. You obviously need to be aware of it and perhaps look at budding up with people, look at running scenarios. Okay, well, what happens if this, and how do I get this out, and how do I extract data from this host or this location? And even if it's a, you know, a small business server, you know, how do I get that one email out from 5 years ago? You know, how long will it take? And I think, you know, they're the sort of scenarios that are probably worth running. Would you agree with that?
True. Well, I mean, show me today. I bet every single person out there listening to this podcast has had a situation where someone has come to them and said, I need to see if I can find that information out from my server. How can I get that out? And now move that to a hosted or cloud scenario, and you're going to have those same questions. Just moving to another location, but those same issues, those same concerns of getting a copy, getting information, it's going to just move to a different location.
And I think, again, you know, it's going to have positives and negatives. I think, like I said, the Office 365, the product that I know, obviously you've got litigation hold, you've got a multi-mailbox search, you've got, again, because they're built for as enterprise products, and they're built to obviously entice the maximum amount of features to bring people on board. So that's what I see as one of the big benefits.
And obviously, I mean, they knew building that, if they didn't have those features there from the get-go, they would not have a product.
Exactly. And what I tell a lot of resellers is, I said, look, you know, you're probably not going to make a lot of money selling, you know, bare bones email services, you know, just send and receive emails. Where the money to be made is learning the advanced features, learning how to do an e-discovery, learn how to do multi-mailbox search, and you can either help your customers or you can potentially sell that skill to other resellers. So it's the high-end features the enterprises have probably had for a long time around security, compliance, that sort of stuff, that there now represents an opportunity for many smaller organizations to start looking at adding to their skill set.
True.
All right, Susan, well, I think that typically brings us to the end of our time. I'd like to obviously thank you for putting yourself out in your time zone to do this. It's most appreciated, and to once again appear on the podcast. So to round things off, maybe you can give everybody a summary and some, you know, some final comments. And then if they do have any further questions or comments or wish to get in contact you, what's the best way to achieve that?
Compliance is something that's not going to go away. In fact, it's going to get larger of an industry, not smaller. To start out, look to certifications such as the CompTIA Security Plus. Look for CISSP. Reach out to your fellow IT pros out on the SMB Managed Services listserv. There's a couple of gentlemen there on that list that really go overboard to help people and to reach out. And again, just look at your client base and see what industries they are in and which ones need really heavy compliance. Obviously, the accounting, anything to do with financial information, anything to do with sensitive information. Look around at the personal identity information that they have, any medical profession. I mean, go down the list of the clients that you have and just think of in terms of how they are touched by compliance issues. It's not going to go away. It's going to increase. Forensics is definitely going to increase. Again, look at those industries and times that you've been asked to gather information and to get information and place it in a manner that it can be looked at by attorneys, and think of ways that you can provide more services like that to your clients, especially as it goes to hosted and browser and cloud-based services, because it's actually going to get harder to gather some of that information than it is easier. Cloud computing brings some interesting nuances to the compliance, but it certainly isn't anything new. It's something we should be doing right now if we're not already doing it.
So once again, a huge amount of information there provided by our special guest on the 50th episode of the Need to Know podcast. For those of you who do want to get in contact with Susan, you can do so by sending her an email, susan@sbslinks.com. Or you can contact her by her world-famous blog, www.sbsdiva.com. So again, I take this opportunity to thank Susan for all the information she shared with us tonight. And thank you, listener, for tuning in to another episode of the Need to Know podcast. And I hope you'll stay with us for our next 50 episodes. Thanks for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the CIOps Publications. For more information, visit www.ciaops.com/publications. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.